This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to the Positive Pop List, everyone. I'm joined today by Jason Chaffetz, and I'm going to begin with the question I ask all my guests. Are you, Jason Chaffetz, a positive populist?
Yes.
Could you ever become one? You're already in there with a yes.
No, I think so. Very good. I love what, you know, I love the show, watching the show, and I'm honored to have been on a few times with you. And I think there is a real positive nature, and I think that taps into what America wants to see, hear, feel from their government leaders. And I get a chance to speak across the country, and it does not matter if I'm in Iowa or Georgia. It doesn't matter. I get the same type of positive reaction to
this. And then let's look at the sort of populist part of it, because you're originally well known to everyone as a Republican member of Congress. And now you're on Fox News. I want to talk about that in a second, because we both kind of made that transition from politics to being in the media, which is like really weird for me. I don't know what it's like for you, but I'll get to that in a second. But I'm more interested in the in sort of your personal navigation of the Trump phenomenon as a Republican, and then someone who saw the Trump phenomenon happening, and this word populism that's associated with that. Just how did that feel when that was going on, and where do you place yourself now?
So, to make a long story very short, I was in the business community for 16 years. I didn't think I was going to be in politics.
Right.
And then through some good luck and some, you know, serendipity, I ended up becoming the campaign manager and the chief of staff to the governor of Utah. And from there...
Who was that?
It was John Huntsman. And I'm very grateful for the experience that he gave me. Which led to my looking at the House, the Senate, and the presidency, which at the time was controlled by the Republicans, or before that was controlled by the Republicans. And I argued, I thought, you know what? The Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and they blew it. They're not doing some simple, basic things that everybody in the country wants us to do. So I got elected the same time as Barack Obama. And I from my vantage point, I saw things getting worse, not better. I remember the $787 billion that Obama got to stimulate the economy, and it was spent on government. It wasn't spent on roads, bridges, and infrastructure. Things like that that just really, to my core, offended me the more I got to dive deep into it, where I could spend 24 hours of my day looking at how the government works. And it was really interesting because you move forward to the Trump presidency. I didn't see it at first. I supported Marco Rubio. I thought he was a good president. Would be a good president. I disagreed with him on immigration issues, but I agreed with him on other things.
Yep.
But the more I saw and listened and heard to Donald Trump, there's a reason why with the 16 or 17 Republicans that were out there, the one that prevailed was not the politician, not the person who did this for a living, but the person who was disruptive, unconventional, and had some different ideas that resonated with the American people.
So let's go. So it's interesting you're saying that for most of your life, you didn't think of yourself as a politician either. You weren't.
No, I was in the business.
You said you worked in business. Tell us about that. What did you do?
I got my degree in corporate communications. I worked for a company, New Skin Enterprises, for 10 and a half years. Then I had my own company.
That?
It was in Utah. I got recruited to play football at Brigham Young University. I wasn't really a football player. I was a place kicker. I grew up playing a lot of soccer and kicked some footballs through those uprights. Met my wife, got a good job. Had my own business, kind of went out on my own. All in Utah.
In Salt Lake?
In just south of Salt Lake. And then my mother actually passed away from cancer. She fought breast cancer and a good 10-year battle. I grew very close to my mother during that time, even closer than I had been before. It was the same year that the Huntsman started the Huntsman Cancer Institute, and I was touched by that. So my entrance to politics was a desire to give back. I didn't know much about John Huntsman, but I thought, wow, this family put in hundreds of millions of dollars to fight cancer. I can put up some campaign yard signs. And it turned out to be a little bit more than that.
Personal connection. But what about the... So just tell us about some of the places you worked. I think it's always interesting. Like, when I think about you know, that some things I've ended up doing. I like you, actually, funnily, I'm very similar. I think of myself mostly as a business person working. I've started companies and worked in companies and so on. What are some of the, that really informs what you, how you approach issues and problems. What, tell us some of the specific, when you started a company, what, tell us about that. How did that
Well, the company I'd worked before that was a high growth company. And so they were making decisions and growing exponentially by tens of millions of dollars. And consequently, a kid in his 20s was taking on management responsibilities he probably shouldn't or wouldn't be able to do otherwise. But when I left that, I was hired to help manage some other companies. And I got to have a real critical eye on saying, look, this works and this doesn't. You should do this and you shouldn't do this. Or I'd come in to help evaluate a company on how they did marketing and sales and how they spent their money and what is their marketing message and how that sales cycle.
Right.
It's really interesting because I think it's that private sector experience. You know how people all the time say, well, I want to get into politics. What should I do? And the best thing I tell them, I said, don't get into politics.
Right.
You got to have some real life experience, and then you can lean on that experience in government. Because I worry that this bureaucracy, these 2.2 million federal employees, they spend their whole life.
That's what they do. Their whole life. Exactly.
And they have no other perspective and no sort of responsibility of understanding what it means to meet a budget and write a check to make sure that it balances and to make an investment. They're oblivious to that whole idea.
And it's not because I'm always at pains to point this out when I've talked about it or tried to work on it as I did back in the UK in terms of reforming the civil service. They're not bad people. It's not that they have an ill intent usually. It's just they don't know any different and they don't have that, exactly as you say, that pressure of the accountability. Now, that's particularly strong when you have your own business, as I have. Tell me about, I really want to know, like, when was that, and how did you get going, and what happened?
So, it was really, I was at the other company until about the year 2000, and then I had gone down to Australia and New Zealand. I was the general manager for Australia and New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating experience. Wanted to get outside of the U.S. Yeah. My wife and I were young and had two kids at the time. But then I came back and I had my own little company. And if I didn't go out and make a sale or get a new client and keep that client happy, guess what? Then we didn't eat. I didn't have an income. Now, we did pretty well enough that I thought, you know.
But did you come back in order to start a business here? Or how what was that?
No.
What was in your mind when you said, you know what, I'm going to do my own thing?
This company, New Skin Enterprise, has been great for me. But I thought, if I don't leave now, then I'll be here forever.
Oh, you see, that's really interesting.
And I felt like I didn't want to do that. I loved the company. I really liked the people. I was there from kind of the ground floor. But I thought, no, I want to get out and broaden my horizons. Yeah. I like the variety of life. That's in part what I liked about Congress is the wide variety.
Yeah.
But I thought, I want to apply myself in a different way. And I like taking on new challenges. And I read a book that was very informative to me in my younger years. It's called, It's not the big that eat the small. It's the fast that eat the slow.
Right. Yes. I heard of that. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was really fascinating that if you stay too long in some place, you get stale. You know, when you first take on a job, and I think this is so true, this is a lesson that's lost on government. When you first take on a job, you're energetic, You got new creative ideas. You look at everything fresh. Everything's positive. But a couple years into it, and they talked about this in the book, you start to get a little stale. Your creativity drops. And then the ideas that maybe you implemented that maybe didn't go so well, you start defending the fort.
Oh.
And you start saying, well, of course I couldn't have made a wrong decision. But that's not in the best interest of a company. And I don't think it's in the best interest of a nation.
Yeah.
I think you actually have to go back and say, wait, there's got to be a better, smarter way to do this that's more efficient, more economical, and better for the taxpayers. And you know what? Maybe we shouldn't even be doing it at all, even though we did it in the past.
That mindset was there with you from your way before you got into politics. You brought that to it.
Yeah.
See, this is just so important, I find.
It's that turnover. I played, like I said, I was just a place kicker. The head coach, Lavelle Edwards, had been there for a long time, but he liked having new assistants because he wanted to look at a new way to play the offense and a new way to play the defense, a new way to do things. And it made us a powerhouse at the time. They were really quite effective and quite good then.
That's just so interesting because you know, we talk about government and the bureaucracy, you know, being you know, sclerotic and all the rest of it. And it's, sometimes people just hear that and think, well, you're just attacking them. You're just being, you don't like civil servants or the public sector or whatever. But it's really not that. It's actually much, much deeper. It's the fact that you're not getting that kind of freshness and energy that you need to deliver good performance in any area.
Well, that's the thing is, I find that most federal workers, they're patriotic, they're hardworking. But I don't think they can help but be stale if they've been in the same job or the same genre for the last 20 years in a row. Freshen it up. Challenge something new. I really think the formula is backwards. I really do believe that. I really wish we could do this. And I wish we could take kind of our youngest and our brightest and find a way, kind of like the military, get in, serve your nation, and then go back and tend to your own field. That's sort of the attitude George Washington took on in the founding of our nation.
That's really great. Honestly, I remember talking to my best friend and we worked together in the government, and I literally remember where I was when we had this conversation. We were just going into to number 10 Downing Street. We were kind of fresh and thinking, how are we going to try and make things better and all the kind of dreams you have. Literally had that conversation. How can we get people to come just for a bit, do a couple of years or whatever, however long makes sense, and then go again? No, it's not a lifer thing.
No. And I think that turnover would serve.
The civil service is so resistant to that.
They are. They'll make all these arguments. Well, you know, we have so much historical knowledge and we know how to do things. And I want to say, well, really? Like, let's have you change departments. Let's have you change industries. Gosh. Let's have the turnover.
So great to hear you talk like that. So I want to understand now you talked about the sort of practical aspect of it, you know, Huntsman and so on, and your transition to politics. But what did that feel like, you know, going from something for the first time really public?
Yeah. No.
What was that like?
Felt tremendous pressure to make sure you get it right, because you're not only dealing with other people's money. And what I found is government is just pervasive in every aspect
of
life. Just
talking about literally that first moment, because, I mean, of saying, okay, I'm now going to run for office. That feeling of putting yourself out there and having a really clear, are you going to win or lose? You know, what was the story? I just want to hear the mechanics of it, I guess, to start with. So we get, you know, was it a primary? You know, how did you get into it?
Yeah, so I did the Huntsman thing and very good. Then I got to see up close personal and how. And I thought, and I looked at the Utah delegation at the time, three House members and two senators. And I felt like there was one that I had a better argument that I didn't
take
like
him out.
Yes.
You're too polite.
Yes. He's a very nice gentleman and I don't want it to be personal. And I won, you know, so I'm trying to be.
So you launched a primary challenge.
I did. And you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to eat one of your own. And like
that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, no, you kind of, you know, give deference.
No, I mean, you did that. That's how, because, but I suppose that's the whole point of it. You get totally fit.
There are
what
elections.
You're saying earlier, to get fresh blood.
That's right. And I said, look, I went to go get Chaffetz.com and imagine how surprised I was. It was available. I mean, I didn't have what you typically normally have, big name ID or big money. I didn't have personal funds to do this. We created a grassroots group of people and went one person at a time and said, if you want to be part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem, I need your help. I can't get from here to there. I'm not going to raise as much money. I don't have the big name ID. But if you can help us, here's what we want to do. Fiscal discipline, limited government accountability, and a strong national defense. And then I'd talk about it from there. Well, that grew. And it wasn't showing up in the public polling. I remember, and I get the number slightly wrong, but it was something like 3.4% I was polling at, plus or minus 4.7%.
Right.
I mean, I was like statistical zero. This is March of 2008.
Wow.
When we got to the primary in June, I won by 20 percentage points.
Wow.
It's because we created this big army of people.
That's amazing.
Who said, yeah, I want to join you and I want to help because I do want to be part
of it. So were
you
seen at that point as the anti-establishment person?
Yeah, it was sort of pre-Tea Party. It was sort of like the front end of the Tea Party that sort of said, there's nothing here that says that. You know, I argued. I said, listen, the founders wanted this to happen.
Yeah.
They didn't want you to sit there forever. If they did, then you'd get elected once and, you know, 40 years later, we would revisit the idea. But it's every 24 months in the House. It's okay to not vote for the same person. You know, I can do this, and here's how I would do it differently. and dove deep into policy. And right.
And then once and you it got, worked. So you won that primary from nothing.
Yeah.
By the big margin. And then effectively, was it a safe district? You're basically...
Pretty well, yeah. Point. I mean, I think every election we had, we were in the 70-something percentage points. So
That safe.
Yeah, it was, okay. I never felt safe, and yeah. you shouldn't ever feel, sure. quote-unquote, safe. But that also gave me a mandate to go back to Congress.
Yeah.
And one of the fundamental things that I think congressmen forget is you don't work for leadership. You work for the people of Utah. Mm-hmm. I remember there was an article that came out, I think it was in Politico, and it said 12 thorns in Speaker Boehner's side. And yes. I was on that list.
Yeah.
And
quite
I think
early on.
Yeah. 11 of the 12 initiatives that John Boehner was for, I was against.
Interesting.
And he would approach
me.
So
you were kind of troublemaker.
Yeah, but with a smile on my face.
That's what we like to see. It's interesting. I was just talking to a colleague here at Fox, and she's saying that she was previously, around about that time, in the D.C. bureau.
Uh-huh.
Or not necessarily at Fox at the time, working in D.C. in the media. And she said it was a huge thing that everyone was talking about and writing about was you and your... like sleeping on the floor and never working the whole time and all this kind of stuff. Just tell us about that a bit.
So when I got to Congress, you know, I wasn't financially independent. We had some means, mm-hmm. enough so to run, but, and mm-hmm. I didn't go into debt in the campaign or anything else. But as I started to look at the pricing of homes in D.C., we make a nice income as a member of Congress. Don't get me wrong, yeah. but not enough to have two homes and two electric bills and right. two, you know, and so there were other members that were sleeping in the office. They just never admitted it. And so I did that. And one of the things I think that distinguished me early on is I've always been kind of offended that members of the House of Representatives have spokespeople. Like, really? You just got elected to be the representative and you have to have a middleman out there to try to protect you so you don't say anything stupid? That never made sense. So I never had a spokesperson. If you had a question... whether it be a constituent.
So, honestly, it's really interesting talking to you because we've kind of connected, you know, been on the show, as you mentioned, and we see each other. But I honestly had no idea how sort of we see things the same way. It was really interesting. Mm-hmm. When I was like, just that particular point about the spokespeople, I remember when we were looking at in government about back in the UK, one of the things I just thought, why that you have all these agencies and right. government bureaucracy, whatever, and they all have communications departments and giant communications departments, strategy departments. Like, why do they need to do this? Why do they need to employ people?
There's got to be some
part of the government, you know, like it's ridiculous.
There's got to be some organization. You want to make sure you have a good website that's of, you know, but if I was elected to the representative, I better be able to answer the questions.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but that was a huge new phenomenon in D.C. That was unheard of. What do you mean?
And I guess this is just before the real kind of takeoff of social media and all the rest.
Well, and
of
that's the other,
around that time.
Yeah, that's. And I was using Facebook and mm-hmm. Twitter mm-hmm. before almost any one of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. At the time, there were Yahoo news groups. Mm-hmm. And so if you were kind of rising the ranks of our right. volunteers, you would go into this Yahoo news group, and that's how I would communicate with mm-hmm. you and give you some insider information. And it was a closed group. Nobody else could see it. Mm-hmm. And social media was my friend because right. I wanted to communicate me directly.
And did this annoy the old guard, if I can use that term? Did you feel that they were
annoyed?
Totally
didn't get it. Right. There's still a lot of members. You know, we just recently had, I think it was the president CEO of Google come mm-hmm. up and testify before the House Judiciary Committee. And what a joke. Those members, they have no idea what to even ask them because they don't understand technology. That's in part because they just don't come from that industry or they just don't have, they're just not part of this newer, younger generation.
There's the technical aspect of it, but also the kind of attitudinal aspect, which is that, you know, you're saying, sorry, I'm not paid a huge amount. I'm going to sleep on the floor or whatever. I heard the story.
Had about a sleeping. Cot, yeah.
Okay. And making a virtue of that, or at least being open about it, and shaking things up and being on the list of people that were, you know, against what John Boehner's trying to do. You can imagine that would, just that whole attitude would really annoy a lot of people.
Yeah.
Did you, yeah, right, but did, how does that... It,
But that's what it's exactly
but
what
are
I got.
They mean to you in person, or do you just pick it up? You know, do they
some
snipe
of them.
At you? How does it?
Some of them.
Okay.
Some of them did. I mean, leadership didn't always appreciate it, but I think also, as a conservative in my heart and a lot of libertarian bent to me, mm-hmm. I felt like I can do it with a smile on my face. You know, Mike Pence actually talks about this mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm a conservative, but I'm not grumpy about it.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, he was actually in our sort of leadership. He was our conference chairman when I was fairly young in the Congress and a good mentor and mm-hmm. friend to me along the way. And I just think getting out there and telling it like it is, I think the American public sniffs it out. Mm-hmm. I think they can tell authenticity mm-hmm. without some focus group or something else. I think that's in part why Donald Trump does so well, even mm-hmm. though everybody doesn't agree with every tweet or thing that he says. Mm-hmm. I think they feel like, wow, that's him unvarnished. You know, that's what he's thinking. Stream of consciousness.
So it's interesting just hearing you talk, because it now makes a lot of sense to me that you ended up in that oversight role. You know,
yeah.
it just feels like that. Because that's really, when you left, that was, remind us, what were your...
So I was the chairman. Yeah, I was the chairman of the oversight committee.
And then was that the only one you were on? You go on lots, don't you?
So I was on the House Judiciary yeah. Committee, but I was really focused on the oversight committee. Mm-hmm. And that's where, after three terms, I became the chairman. It was only right. the fifth time in 100 years that had happened.
What?
But it happened because I focused
from being
on
it. To being the chairman.
Yeah. Usually it's all based on seniority.
So and someone else gets it who's
been there longer,
but not on that committee necessarily.
Well, the three people that I ran against, there were four of us in the running, all of them had served longer on the committee and raised more
money. On that particular committee?
Yeah, and all had raised more money for the party. So I was dead last in seniority, dead last. Huh. But I created a case and I showed the passion for it. And I said, we're going to do things differently than had been done before.
Yeah.
And this is how we're going to do that. And I literally wrote a 75-page playbook
yeah.
and handed it out and made the case, and my colleagues elected me to chair that
again
committee.
It's the same as with the primary same
yeah.
sort of attitude
yeah. yeah I'm the underdog here, I get that, but I'm going to make the case.
I see why you could still connect with the disruptive kind of aspect, and I mean I always think of that as a positive. I know that, you know, you've got right. to be careful about the consequences for people, but generally speaking, and that's how I was seen in the UK government. It's like this is like and you know, but some supported me and others kind of mocked me in the meat, you know, whatever, but that's the, you know, it's like that notion of shaking things up, I think, is really important.
I remember, not to jump too far, yeah. but when the Benghazi attack happened,
yeah.
I was the subcommittee chairman of national security.
Uh-huh.
And I remember talking to the legislative liaison from Hillary Clinton's office, and he was sort of laughing at me, thinking, hey, we'll just waste the time and let the clock run out.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time I really lost my cool in Congress, because I started yelling at the guy over the
mm-hmm.
phone.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my staff had to kind of pull me back a little
okay.
bit. It's the only time I really, I was a little over the top.
Yeah.
But I was so infuriated by the attitude and the approach
mm-hmm.
and the brazen nature of him saying, yeah, we'll just wait this out. You're never going to get these documents. I'm never going to
wow.
get these up to you. I said, really? I'm going to go to the end of the earth, and you have no idea how
wow.
long and how hard I'm going to go after this. All
That's
I'm seeking
cool.
is the truth, and it served me well. I certainly didn't have it all figured out. There are a lot of things I wish I was able to accomplish in Congress, but...
So what would you put... I mean, you talked about... Well, what are the other things that you'd say you were most proud of doing, I guess, in that role, in oversight, or
Well, I really truly believed, the more I studied it, that our founders really wanted a vigorous oversight mm-hmm. of the executive branch. It was the biggest committee at the time, early in the Congress. It grew, it ebbed, it flowed, it had different names. Abraham Lincoln, when he came to Congress, served on that. He
okay.
actually challenged the president about the Mexican-American War. He didn't believe the president on where the shots were fired, and his nickname was called Spotty,
uh-huh.
and because he wanted to know the exact spot in
wow.
which the shots were fired, and he went around the country giving these speeches. I was fascinated by that. And so you move to modern day, you know, when I'm in the Congress, there's always somebody doing something stupid somewhere. And I do believe in accountability and that transparency.
Mm-hmm.
That makes for a better government when somebody's looking over your shoulder. And I'm very proud of the fact that everything from Benghazi to the IRS scandal to the stuff we did with the DEA and the Secret Service and Fast and Furious. You know, I got to play a role in
all of that.
There's
a lot of stuff, exactly. So then, and again, now I kind of understand, but I'd love you to put it in your words, decided to leave Congress.
Yeah, there
which
came,
I think a lot of people were surprised about. You were like a big deal.
I was sort of at the pinnacle of my power, so to speak. You know, that's what very few people get to serve as chairman. I mean, there are only 18 authorizing committees in all the House, and I was one of the chairmen. Right in the middle, I kind of packed it up and said, see ya. I knew that I had soured. I knew my life was a little bit out of balance. On a personal standpoint, I had spent more than 1,500 nights away from my family, and I happen to have a wife I love and kids I adore, and that was hard. Three kids, two of which are now married, and our youngest is a senior in high school.
Married? Oh, my God.
I know.
Like, yes, indeed.
Okay, that makes sense.
But, you know, I had done
interesting
essentially more than a decade, even though it was 8.5 years in Congress. But, you know, count the chief of staff time and count the campaigning time, because I spent 2 years campaigning. And I was just out of balance. I was furious at Jeff Sessions, who was the attorney general, by not providing the documents that we needed for me to do my job. Very frustrated with Republican leadership, who didn't see the value in oversight and didn't have my back and my support. And sort of the combination of all of that came to, all right, I'm not here for a career. I'm not here for a lifetime. Time to pass the baton and let somebody else try to do it. I'm not the only one that can do this job. And I was very inspired by, and I don't want it to sound too corny, but I was very inspired by George Washington when he gave his speech and he left the presidency. And he could have stayed. I could have stayed. I would have probably gotten reelected, and I'd still be the chairman. But now that they were in the minority, I'd be the ranking member. But nevertheless.
So you said the word soured was really interesting. Do you mean you soured on it? Or you felt that you had gone a bit.
I was trying to practice what I was preaching. You know, it goes back to that book. You know, it's not the big that eat the small; it's the fast that eat the slow. And I was going a tenacious pace. I was just going after it, but I also knew that it was time for a fresh approach. And I was just very frustrated that I could not do my job with the lack of our leadership supporting me. And I fought the Obama administration tooth and nail to get documents. And the mainstream media and the Obama administration just sort of laughed at me. And then when I sat with Jeff Sessions and had a similar conversation, I just thought, this is ridiculous.
So when was that? That was very early on.
It was March or so of the new administration. And when I sat down with him, he was the new attorney general. I'd only been there a couple of weeks. And I came to him with about... I'm forgetting the number, but like 15 different things that I needed. And I had a case to be made. And he basically said no to all of them. Not going to do anything on the Hillary Clinton stuff. The Brian Pagliano wasn't going to prosecute him. He was the IT specialist. I mean, I got stories. We don't have enough. There's not enough space on the internet for me to explain all the stories.
It's really shocking that he was so against.
Oh, he was terrible.
Right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. And he would say things to me like...
because that was before any of the reporting about, you know, whatever, the struck of, you know, the whole kind of, all the bits that have come out about how...
So Brian Pagliano...
The FBI were...
Brian Pagliano was the IT specialist working with Clinton. He had an immunity agreement, but no cooperation agreement in his to cooperate with the government. We had called him to testify before Congress, and he didn't show up. I issued a subpoena. He didn't show up. I issued a second subpoena, had the U.S. Marshals serve him, and he didn't show up. Well, we held him in contempt in our committee, and we sent a letter saying this person should be prosecuted. And Jeff Sessions' response to me in short was, I can't do that. It's just too close to Clinton. In the meanwhile, he's out there tweeting that he doesn't do anything political. He takes the job very seriously. But I had eyeball-to-eyeball experience with him. And I just thought, this is so absolutely wrong. And I went to everybody I could in the White House. Reince Priebus, Bannon, I mean, Jared Kushner. I went to everybody I could think of to try to say, you got to help me. Don McGahn, who was general counsel. And they all said, look, we just don't meddle or get involved with the judiciary. With the Department of Justice. And I thought, but the president is the constitutionally elected.
Right.
Exactly. I agreed. But I also understood that the president was under investigation with his special counsel.
Right, so they didn't want to look like they were being heavy-handed, even though they had absolute authority to do it.
Exactly.
That's really interesting. So if you're sort of drawing up kind of, I mean, had you decided to leave before that encounter with Sessions? Or was that really the final kind of, I've got to get out?
When Donald Trump, surprising to all of us, was elected, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm actually going to get to do my job.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually going to get to the core of what I need to expose what's going on. Because a lot of times you do an investigation and there's nothing there.
Right.
Those never make the headlines, don't even make an article in the paper. Okay. So, but I thought I can actually get to the root of the problem or at least find out the truth. No. And I could not tell the difference between Loretta Lynch, mm-hmm. Eric Holder, and Jeff Sessions. They were all the same to me.
That's
because they
so
acted.
Shocking, isn't it?
And it was very frustrating. But before that, so up until that time, I had this surge of optimism and then this huge letdown.
Wow. Okay. Well, we haven't got too much time left, but I want to kind of bring it up to date.
Right.
And just talk about the experience more recently here at Fox. So how did that come about, and what do you make of it so far?
I love it because it goes back, and you and I talked about this off air, and mm-hmm. we talked about it on one of the on your show. Mm-hmm. I really do buy into this whole Margaret Thatcher approach, which says win the argument, then you can win the votes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I am a communicator at my heart. It's what I got my degree in. It's what I did in my mm-hmm. private life before I did politics. And I find that there are millions of people that do care and they want to know. And I've had that experience in that insight that is so rare and unique. And the further away from it, the more I'm like, wow, I can't believe I got to do that. Mm. So after my wife and I decided, all right, time to go. Then I went and talked to a few networks. Mm-hmm. I got two offers mm-hmm. and ended up going with Fox News. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting with Jay Wallace, who's the president at the time mm-hmm. and one of the co-presidents. And I said, what do you want from me? And he said, he was great. He said, I just want authenticity. I just want you to be you. Don't feel like you have to support anybody or do anything. Mm-hmm. What we're paying you for, what we want you to do is just talk from your heart, your own experiences and your own perspective. And I thought this is a perfect fit. It's a really a good fit. And so better balance in my life, good experience, wonderful mm-hmm. people. And do
true,
that.
Isn't it? That's what I found as well. And a lot of people look at Fox and they say, you know, I don't want to turn this into some sort of corporate propaganda, but just since we both had the same experience, really, mm-hmm. of complete career change to get into.
Right.
And I remember I still am constantly just struck by just what a warm, sort of kind, nice place it is with just nice people. You know, I mean, I know that some may think, well, you haven't met, you know, so and so, whatever, but that has been my experience.
Yeah. No. And
just nice
people assume the conspiracy theorists out there, oh, they must want you to do this or that. No, never had anybody push me.
That's exactly the same. But it's interesting because it feels to me like one thing, again, one of the things that people say, when you said that was what you're going to be doing, just what were some of the reactions? I mean, how did that go down?
Oh, that I think legitimately there were a number of people in my own district that were disappointed, frustrated that I'd just been elected, hadn't been there too long into my fifth term.
Right.
And then I was stepping down and I reminded them that get in, serve and get out. I was not going to make this there for a lifetime, that mm-hmm. was my mm-hmm. ultimate plan. And that my family was a huge priority.
Yeah.
I was missing my kid's life and I wasn't going to sit there for another year and a half and try to pretend I'd still be there today, Steve.
Right. I know. It's amazing. It just feels like you've been part of it here for so long, you know, but
it's been about a year and a half now.
Yeah. Roughly the same as when I started. So I think that it's just so interesting talking to you because I think if there's one thing that Fox is, it's not so much the ideology which people ascribe to it and all the rest of it. There's something about Fox that seems to me it's about talking back to the establishment. It's about having that sort of spikiness.
Yeah.
And that has come across so strongly from everything you've said about how you saw, you know, how you first got into politics and how you saw it then. It's just a natural progression. It's really interesting.
Yeah. It's been fascinating. You know what? It changes every day and life goes on and I don't know exactly where it's going to go in the future. Would I maybe serve in another role in a public sector at some point? Yeah, maybe. Not yet,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, plenty of time.
Yeah.
Well, Jason Chambers, I definitely agree. I think you really are a positive populist.
Well, thank
you. For sure. So
thank you.
I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's been great. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case, available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.